Today is opposite day. Well, for us anyway.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
Actually, oddly, there is a National Opposite Day. I say that in the same spirit that there's probably a National Gopher Day and a National Bear Day and a National Everything Else Day. I'm not sure who counts these things as official, but there is a National Day calendar. And if you look it up, there is an opposite day. It's January 25th. For most people, some people say it's a different day. Obviously, they have a different calendar. Anyway, the point is, on this National Day calendar, one of the things it says is, what are some things you can do on opposite day? Well, read about the North and South Poles. Now, this is an absurd list, but I'm just going to read it to you. It's very short. Express opposite emotions like sad and happy, excited and disappointed. Experiment with opposite flavors. Taste sour and sweet, spicy and bland. What's the opposite of bitter? Anyway, the last one it says is, play with opposite sounds. Whisper, then shout. Cry, then laugh. Now, I'm going to pause on this one. Now, I had the topic, the idea of what I wanted to talk about, and then looked up opposite day because I wanted to talk about it in that way, because I do want to talk about some opposites that are ironically less different than we think they are. And so that was my objective. And the fact that the last thing in this list was cry, then laugh, points to one of those opposites that we recognize is very curious. It's very odd. And so along with opposites, kind of hand in hand, go ironies, because you use, for instance, juxtaposition, the juxtaposition of opposites to create irony sometimes, that you would take someone who is isolated in a desert and speak of them as being intimidated by crowds, something like that would be a juxtaposition of opposite ideas that creates some kind of irony and so on. So ironies and opposition, they're going to inherently be related, and both of those concepts can force us or invite us to recognize how much more things have in common than we're normally aware of. So, you know, opposites are both, opposites, obviously, as different as we can imagine things capable of being. But they are, and this is ironic in itself, that opposites are actually as similar as possible in practically every way. And yet, with one difference, that's what makes them the way we normally talk about opposites. Opposites are, you could say, and this is just colloquially, are a lot more like kissing cousins than total strangers. The opposite, for instance, of boy. I'm not staying on the semantics through the whole thing, don't worry. I just want to get this point across about opposites so that you can understand why this is worth applying to some things that are pretty practical by the end of the conversation. But as I say, opposites, they have a lot more in common than we think. So, for instance, the opposite of boy is not, we can just pick something, black hole. Which is, boy being animal and human and, right now juvenile. It's not black hole, because you could say, well, a black hole is non-animal, it's non-human, and it's ancient or even non-temporal. I'm not really saying it's non-temporal, but you make an argument. Anyway, the point is, that's as opposite as you can think of as boy. But we don't say the opposite of boy is black hole. We say the opposite of boy is girl. I know some boys who are black holes, by the way. You can't get anything out of them. Whatever goes into them, it just disappears, mostly food. Anyway, the point is, the opposite of boy is girl. And it's because a boy is animal, so is a girl. A boy is human, so is a girl. A boy is juvenile, so is a girl. The difference is just gender. And that difference is what makes the opposition so poignant, so worth observing or talking about. That's the case with a lot of things, that when we are observing things that we think are as far apart as they could possibly be, they're actually a lot more similar than we think they are. So laughing and crying is always my go-to example. I remember 30 years ago when I was first looking at this consideration, it was because I had heard about some study that had observed that the same muscles are used for laughing and crying, that it's biologically, they are biologically indistinguishable behaviors. That's not quite true, because over the years since then, we've come to recognize where the differences are, which is an important concept also for the conversation later. But on laughing and crying, recognizing how similar they are is really where we are in our natural existence. If you pay attention to another person when they're laughing or crying, you realize how identical those behaviors are. So as an example, I just, in one of those studies that does recognize the difference, by the way, one of the opening paragraphs in it is a fascinating recognition of just how long we've realized those two behaviors are so similar. And so I'll read to you the paragraph from the study, this sort of academic paper about it. This is from the National Institutes of Health. The website is in the National Library of Medicine and the National Center for Biotechnology Information. So those are all subcategories. Daisy will link to it for you. But the article is called The Origin of Smiling, Laughing, and Crying, The Defensive Mimic Theory. This is by this guy named Michael S. A. Graziano. Anyway, the quotation is this. This is the opening paragraph, if I remember correctly, in that article. In a famous moment in Homer's Odyssey, again, I'm reading from this paper. In a famous moment in Homer's Odyssey, a room full of villains laughs uncontrollably at a joke, their eyes streaming with tears. The poet evocatively paints the moment as foreshadowing the weeping they will soon be doing when Odysseus kills them all. Even 3,000 years ago, the article goes on, observers of human nature noticed the eerie similarity between laughter and crying, especially as the intensity of the emotional expression increases. And you understand what I mean. It's not like we confuse chuckles with weeping, but when you are really belly rolling a laugh, and then you see a person who's genuinely from their core grieving, the behaviors are almost indistinguishable, and you understand what I mean. And so putting it in the context of something that was written 3,000 years ago really drives home the point of how obvious that ironic kind of opposition is. We all know the confusion. We've all seen that. Is he laughing or crying? I can't tell. We've all asked that at some point. But we all also know the difference in ourselves. I mean, the obvious difference in yourself, you're not in the middle of a belly roll laugh. You know, your stomach is hurting. You've been laughing so long, you're embarrassed because everybody else has finished laughing and you can't stop. You've never been in the middle of that laughing and thought to yourself, oh, wait, I can't tell whether I'm sad or happy. There's no confusion in your mind. You know the difference within yourself. That's not confusing. But what we realize is that if there's so much similarity in what we're observing in the other person, and that difference, which is really difficult to find sometimes, where is it? Well, obviously, it's in the mind. We know that, but that's a huge fundamental question. You know, where is that? Where do you get to observe what that is? Is it just brain and the activity of the brain and so on? So, you know, what it might mean that those two things are so easily confused, if I were looking at it from the outside, if I were looking at it as a scientist or something like that, oh, I want to see, is there really a difference? And how do we observe the difference and so on? That, you know, it might mean, as, and for instance, this study points it out this way, that they actually have the same origin. Now, I'm going to make a note on this. We'll talk about it in a few moments. I'm not committed to evolutionary theory. I'm also not committed to bashing everybody who thinks that way. That's just not the priority for me. But I'm not saying that it doesn't matter. It does matter. But the reason we're going to talk about it is not because it is the end-all and be-all of understanding the truth of how creation came to be or how animals came to exist. It has nothing to do with that. I'll explain why we're using it in a minute, even though we have questions about it. And a lot of the people I talk to would have questions about it. There's still a reason to talk about it. And in that study, they're definitely taking an evolutionary approach and pointing out that laughing and crying seem so similar because they probably have exactly the same point of origin, which, by the way, has something to do with mimicking the behavior of whatever it is that you're anticipating or demonstrating a kind of fear in response to sudden changes, whatever. It goes way beyond that, but you can read the article yourself. As I mentioned, Daisy will link to it. But it could also mean, I said, it could mean they have a similar point of origin, that they originate from the same thing, and they just haven't diverged that much physically in terms of what's being expressed in the person. Or it could mean that we just haven't found the difference yet. We just didn't notice the difference yet. And there are other studies that have revealed that. So, like, there are more detailed studies of the facial muscles, I think involving, I've forgotten what you call it, but, you know, an active MRI, whatever those things are actually called, a functional MRI, when you're actually watching a thing live as it's moving through an MRI, that actually reveal that there are a few differences in the muscles, the facial muscles, and the reaction they have when it's grieving on the one hand or this jolly, rejoicing kind of laughter on the other hand. So, you know, maybe we just haven't seen the difference yet. The point is, they're a lot more similar. Laughing and crying are as far at the opposite extremes of the emotions as we could possibly express. You know, hence the faces that you see on theaters and things. Oh, there's laughing and there's crying. Those are the two extremes, and yet they're extremely similar. Ironically, extremely similar. That's the point of the expression. Anyway, so I do want to back up just for a second and say, because this will come up again, not just in this episode, but in subsequent episodes as well, as a side note on how we're going to have this conversation and why I'm going to talk about some things that some of you are not going to be comfortable with. And I'm fine with that. I again, it's not my world. It's not the world I live in or swim in or live or die by. But it is important in the conversation that we'll be having. So this is a side note on science for non-scientists. And another way of saying that is it's a side note for naturalistic theories. You know, evolution is a naturalistic theory. I'm not saying you have to deny the existence of God to believe in evolution, but I am saying the theory itself certainly doesn't rely on God. That's the nature of evolution, that it's mechanistic. But anyway, so what I'm describing is how a non-scientist like myself and some of you could think about science, or how a non-naturalist, meaning a supernaturalist, we believe in God. Most of us, and not all of you, but most of you who are listening to this, you believe in God. And because of that, you're a supernaturalist. You believe there is something beyond the natural order of things. How would you think about naturalistic theories? And so I just want to insert one little crevice into this wall of determination about how you may think of how you think of naturalism as a supernaturalist, or how you may think you think about science as a non-scientist, right? So here's my attempt to chisel in a little cavity in there for you to think differently about it. And it is, and I'm going to use a metaphor. Ironically, I'm using a metaphor about math. For non-mathematicians, I mean, technically, I'm a non-mathematician. I took a lot of math when I was in college. I love math. My nature is mathematical, so I enjoy all the stuff that goes with, all the complicated forms of math, as other people would think of it. It's not really the complicated forms. I gave up when I got past differential equations on the degree because I realized it took work, and I was only willing to do it when it was free and easy for me. So getting through calculus and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, the point is the value of I, this is super simple, imaginary numbers. I mean, just by the time you get through, you know, natural numbers and whole numbers and real numbers and rational numbers, and you finally get to imaginary numbers. It's still, you're in elementary school when people start talking about this stuff, right? So nothing complicated. We can all understand what I mean by this. The value of I. You remember I. Okay, I'm going to ask my producer, because I didn't talk to her about this ahead of time, so I'm asking her right now. You can answer this question. All I'm asking is, do you remember I? Do you remember it from school? Do you remember talking about it? So, okay, I get a no. So I'll give a very brief explanation of what I'm talking about, that when we use the little letter I in just in pure math, in a lot of other contexts, use a different letter like J or something. But in math, in pure math, use I to represent so here's the thing you say about I, that I squared is negative one. That's what makes it imaginary. And by the way, as I understand it, we call them imaginary numbers, if I remember this correctly, because originally when René Descartes, my personal hero of a lot of ideas, but on this one it's kind of funny, he was using it derogatorily. You know, well, there are these people who use imaginary numbers, because mathematicians have talked about the concept, you know, since the ancient Greek days. I say I don't know. I mean, I know there are arguments to be made that it's been talked about since ancient Greece. But it was during the Enlightenment that people really started relying on I to do calculations. And I is imaginary, and Descartes made fun of it, because it's nonsensical. It's a nonsensical number. You can't multiply two negative numbers, like negative one, and get a negative number. It's not possible. So to say that I squared is negative one is impossible. A number multiplied by itself can't give you a negative number. So it's sort of like the normal way people talk about it is the square root of negative one is I. That's not a meaningless statement, but it's not as useful, because we make mistakes when we start combining it with other numbers in that way. But anyway, the point is, you don't care. The math part of it, put aside. You get how ridiculous it would be to say negative 1 times negative 1 equals negative 1. It doesn't. So I isn't negative 1. And you can't say 1 times 1 equals I equals negative 1, because 1 times 1 is 1. So I squared means you have to multiply a number by itself and get negative one. That's not possible. And yet there are some times that we're doing calculations and we end up with the square root of negative one being in the formula. And it's like, well, I can't do anything. I'm lost. And we just throw it away. We tear it up into shreds and we throw it away. I can't do anything now because I got a square root of a negative number. It's impossible to do anything. But it's not. So what we do is replace the negative sign with the square root of negative one under that, you know, under the square root sign. It becomes I instead. And now we just pretend like it's any other kind of variable or any other kind of constant. And we just start using it in the formula. And if you do that, the formulas actually work. It's not nonsense. It's not something divided by zero. There actually is a meaningful outcome you can get from formulas when you use it. Now, my reason for saying that is there is, you know, the derogatory nature of the term. It's an imaginary number. It's just foolishness. It's nonsense. It's absurdity. Doesn't undermine the fact that there is usefulness in the concept, that what we gain from it is the ability to solve some problems we wouldn't have worked through if we didn't have that tool. And I'm saying the same thing about paradigms in science, about ways of thinking about the world. Because, you know, for some people who are non-scientists, and this doesn't mean they can't think scientifically, but for some non-scientists, there's a dubiousness about all of science because paradigms change over time. We go from a flat earth to a whatever. And I get the arguments against that. I get the arguments against that dubiousness because it's science itself and its observations and its willingness to adjust its footing based on the evidence that causes us to move from one paradigm to the next. I get that. I'm not anti-science. But I am saying to you, even if you are dubious about the truth claims that science can make about certain things, it doesn't undermine the usefulness of the tools they're creating to make those claims. You don't even have to agree with all the conclusions or the claims that they make to realize that there can be some real usefulness in those tools. If you can say, I don't believe in all this climate change science, but you know, people are making observations about buoys in the sea and how they're floating and how much heat there is in the ocean at that time and how whatever the waves are greater or lesser and blah, 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 can still be interesting information that could be used to draw meaningful conclusions. I can disagree with reductionist psychiatry, and I do. Reductionist psychiatry would be a form or even of any kind of, examination of the human being. In a reductionist version would be reducing the human being to nothing more than material, than a material being, a material object. And so reductionist kind of psychiatry would be the kind that says there's just a brain. There's no mind independent of the brain. There's no soul going on. There's no free will happening. They're just neural firings and stuff. And what we do are just chemical things to control what's going on in the brain. I can disagree with the conclusions of reductionist psychiatry. I can disagree with the whole paradigm that would reduce anything to materialism. I can disagree with that entire thing and still get great value from the work that reductionists do to understand the parts of the brain that do very directly correlate with what's going on in the human mind. It can still be really interesting and compelling and useful. And it's the same exact thing with evolutionary theories. You can disagree with evolutionary theory. You can disagree completely with it, and there's good reason to do so if you're a supernaturalist. Again, it relies entirely on a naturalistic mechanism. I get that. So you can disagree with evolutionary theories and yet still be just, I have been stunningly informed by the theories and the tools that they use to draw their conclusions. Because in drawing a conclusion about why creatures would have whatever features they have, why they would behave the way they do, why they would have the types of limbs that they have, why they would see the way they do, why in evolution this means that nature selected for this or that, all of those conclusions about that being a mechanism are also observations about how brilliantly this organism functions in the present world. And whether you care about the mechanism that brought it to pass or not, and of course, I believe God has a design hand in that. There's no sense in which I wouldn't believe that, regardless of what mechanism you want to adopt or not adopt. I believe it's God's design that brings it about. It makes me say, that's amazing. It's incredible. And it gives me an appreciation for those things and an understanding of those things and an understanding of how those things might inform us about what our functions are that I wouldn't have if I didn't have somebody doing that background work. So using the theory doesn't mean you have to buy its truth claims about the history and mechanisms of the world and how it came to pass, because I will probably make some references to it over the, at least this episode, but maybe a couple of more episodes after this, at least one episode after this, because I read a book recently from, it's called The Price of Altruism, and it's about George Price. And so this, I've mentioned him before on a previous episode. We talked about the Price formula, which is used in evolutionary theory. And it's fairly fascinating. By the way, it is a fascinating book. I'm not recommending it. I mean, it's a little harsh at times, but I am recommending it because it is convicting also. And it is, I've seen a lot of Christians go through some of the things that he went through. And he comes to a tragic ending. So it's a tough read. If you are going to commit yourself to it, I'm just going to tell you, it's a tough read. Emotionally, at least for me, it was a tough read. But I will say the fascinating thing to me, I mean, the thing I loved about the book, the reason I wanted to read it, is because it's about altruism. I love altruism. It's, you know, it's my theme. It's my topic. It's the thing I love to study. And their study of it, especially in this book, is from a science perspective, the perspective of evolutionary theory, of genetics, things like that. And George Price is right in the middle of that, and he has a conversion experience. And so it's a very compelling story. And again, it's not like a happy ending, and it's not pristine. It's not like you're going to play it for your 9-year-old while you're in the car. I'm not saying that, but it is a smart book, and it's got a lot of interesting things in it. And you know, part of it, because it's all about science, does have to do with evolutionary theory. I mean, that's part of what George Price was doing while he was completely committed to becoming a faithful follower of Christ. and while he was making a mess of that process at the same time, but also while he was at the same time working on some of the most difficult intellectual problems of the day. So he's a really smart guy. So anyway, it's a fascinating book, The Price of Altruism. That's, I just want to give an acknowledgement that that has stirred up a lot of the thoughts that I've been having and ideas that I've been working through on these ideas and others. And again, altruism is an inherent topic of interest for me. So what's fascinating in this book, it introduces a recognition that evolutionists had to make in the process of trying to find out in their minds, in the way they think of the world, whether altruism could have emerged from the evolutionary process, if it could have been selected for by nature, as people say. And the fascinating thing in that observation is that it came down to this surprisingly similar opposite, that in order to study altruism in populations, just mathematically, even abstractly, but also in observing different populations and what they do, how they react with each other, in order to study altruism, which, you know, you have to give a definition to, what do you mean by altruism? Well, acting in the interest of others, even if it involves personal cost. That's the idea. That's the idea of selflessness. So I'm acting against my own interest, but I'm doing it in the interest of others. That doesn't seem like it would be selected for by nature. It seems like it would be selected out because you're acting to your own disadvantage. I mean, disadvantage is what's selected against. And your advantage, I know these things are a lot more technical than I'm describing them, but I'm not wrong. I mean, it's in this category. That's why people think of it the way they do. And acting in the interest of others is just not a thing that gives you an advantage in the game of life and getting your genes replicated in the future. You wouldn't think. And so part of the evolutionary journey of people trying to figure out how the world could have come to be what it is, how could people have come to be what they are? And this is from the beginning. I mean, and it's not like Darwin's not thinking about it in his original works. He's already thinking about the problem, I'm putting it in quotes, as a person like that would see it, the problem of altruism. Because self-interest would be the thing that you would think would preserve a being long enough to reproduce and get its genes passed down to the next generation and so on. And so there are all kinds of solutions people work on to try to work through that, and I'll mention a few of those in just a moment. But as evolutionists began to study this and tried to develop some formula that would explain how the genes could be replicated at a level that would maintain altruism in whatever group or kin or whatever, as they're trying to work on that, they come to realize that another behavior that they have to take into consideration is another behavior that involves personal cost. So altruism is acting in the interest of others, even if it involves personal cost. But there's also this thing that is acting to harm another, even if it involves a personal cost, which doesn't make much sense to us until I put a word on it, which is spite. We behave with spite, which means acting to harm another, even if it does involve a personal cost. And those are actually very, very similar behaviors because they don't require that there's a personal cost, but they are present even if there is a personal cost. And at some level, there is always a personal cost because, you know, it takes some resources, no matter how simple what you're doing is. Now, even if you're just pulling a lever, it still took you a moment to do that and some focus and so on. And so it's a little bit of a disadvantage if it doesn't give you any advantage. So altruism, it's odd. Altruism and spite, things that we would consider exact opposites, and they are exact opposites, are actually so similar that the formulas that you would derive about them, regarding them, in if you were doing evolutionary theory, would be pretty much identical. And it makes it a really interesting feature of human nature to put altruism and spite right next to each other. But in the same way that crying and laughing have this identical nature in some ways, and yet we know there's an obvious distinction between the two. That's true about altruism and spite. There's an obvious distinction between the two, the difference between interest and harm. It can be reduced. So you could say, I can eliminate that difference by reducing it simply to affecting the other, affecting someone else, even if it involves personal cost. So you see, altruism and spite are actually exactly the same thing. that doesn't make them the same thing. It just means I can recognize how similar they are now. But given the complexity of human actions and consequences, you can understand why that kind of reduction might make sense. It would be almost impossible, again, to distinguish between spite and altruism when you take into consideration behaviors that are considered enabling, for example. Because an enabling behavior, obviously, you're intending interest. Oh, well, in my mind, I was helping. But actually, you're producing harm, which sometimes is dramatic and almost immediate. Oh, I was just trying to help. Here, I'm waving them across the street. You know, they're dead. Oh, I didn't see that. I was just trying to help. You know, is that, wait, was that an act of altruism or spite? I mean, it was not in your self-interest. You thought you were helping the other person. You ended up destroying the other person. No, it wasn't spite because I didn't intend harm for them. So intention is the difference. But you can see how muddled the topics could get. And in naturalism and some other systems, the reduction of things that are this complex is down to self-interest. So when you're in evolutionary terms, you say natural selection, you know, that thing that eliminates those who are weaker for the benefit of those who are stronger, stronger meaning they're fitter, meaning they're more likely to reproduce and have offspring, and therefore their genes make it through to the next generation, that natural selection, maybe through, if I were a reductionist, and I'm not, maybe through reciprocity, meaning I am altruistic because I think you're going to be altruistic to me. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, that kind of thing. So through reciprocity or through kin selection. Now, that part makes sense. Well, things that have siblings that are altruistic are more likely to survive and reproduce. And so among families, you're going to reproduce genes that include altruism because they're included in the sibling genes, even though that creature died because it warned its brothers and sisters that something bad was about to happen, and it happened to them instead. That kind of thing could happen. So kin selection, and there are even arguments about whole group selection that involves a lot of complexity. You can read the book if you want to read about that stuff. It's too much for us to talk about today. We might talk about it another time. Anyway, the point is, in evolutionary terms, we could reduce even altruism or spite, but altruism is really what we want to talk about, to natural selection by saying, oh, well, as you work on it, an altruistic being is more likely to pass its genes down to the next generation, not directly, but through its brothers and sisters, for example. In which case, you're saying the gene is selfish. This is just Richard Dawkins, you know, the selfish gene. That's the argument, you know, that underlies it, or part of the argument that underlies it, that ultimately every individual, he wouldn't do it through kin selection or group selection. I mean, he doesn't do it at all now, I know that. But I mean, in the book, it would be about the individual being able to pass its genes down, but it would be a selfish act that appeared to be altruistic. It would be a selfish act that happened to contain something that looks like altruism. That's the naturalistic reduction about altruism that could happen. And in psychological terms, we do the same thing. Psychological egoism that I've talked about on here with different episodes many, many, many times, and not nearly as often as I wanted to, by the way, in case you're thinking, yeah, it was a lot of times. That wasn't nearly as many times as I wanted to. Psychological egoism, the idea that you can only ever do what you want to do. You can only want what you want. So you can only make a choice that's based on what you want. You can only want what do what you want to do. So even if you're acting altruistically, it's just because you wanted to do it. It made you feel better. It scratched some itch that you had. And so psychological egoism drives us in a very naturalistic kind of sense, by the way, to the point of acknowledging that even our interest in others is really just fulfilling the self-interest that we have. We can do that naturalistically. But if, and once for me, because I do tolerate the possibility of supernaturalism, I don't just tolerate it, I believe in it. Once we tolerate the possibility of a radical, you know, something that acts against what everything else tells us the rules are, once we tolerate the possibility of a radical in the environment, once we accept the possibility that there could be something supernatural that exists, and people don't like this concept at all. They do not. And when I say people, I mean most of us. I just mean normal people, including myself. We get uncomfortable at this moment This is, you know, when Einstein doesn't like the idea of quantum physics and some of the aspects of quantum physics, and calls it spooky metaphysics. Spooky metaphysics has become sort of the go-to term for people to criticize the things that I'm about to say. And not criticize unjustly. It's sort of a fair criticism. We are appealing to something beyond nature and just saying, yeah, I just can't see it happening, except that there is this radical intervention of something beyond nature, meaning the I know not what is doing it. But I don't know not what. I know who, you know, and I talk about him all the time. So once we tolerate the possibility of a radical like supernaturalism in the environment, then love could actually be a thing. Altruism could actually be a thing in itself. It could actually exist, a legitimate desire and concern for others that goes beyond the self, that is outside of self-interest. It would have to be this, I get it, in order for us to understand it at all. It would have to be something of an intruder on the natural order. So you get what I'm saying, that the two, spite and altruism, are very closely related to each other, and self-interest and altruism can be very closely related together, but they're not the same thing, and we can recognize what the difference is. So where I want to go from there is going to seem like a pretty far leap. So what I'm going to do is just introduce the concept, and then we'll do another episode, and we'll talk about why I think this is so important. I do want to give you why I think this is so important before I finish today, though. So when I look at some apparent ironies from opposite perspectives, and I'll talk about these details next time, I think, you know, the most obvious ones, and I'm not going to do any of the details today, but just to introduce the concept, some of the most obvious ones to me, because I was so engaged in politics and economic disputes among politicians and policymakers, that automatically to my mind come the differences between a libertarian, and that's what I mean when people say conservative, I don't think they think through necessarily every time what they mean by that. And so I use the word libertarian very often to make the point of conservative being about preserving personal liberties above everything else, right? That's the highest priority. So that kind of conservative is what I mean. The libertarian perspective on one side, and then the more progressive, or as some other people would say, it's socialist sort of perspective on the other side. And what I find interesting is that if you work through their two views on the economy and why they hold the views that they do, there are obvious differences, just like there are between laughing and crying. We know on the inside what the difference is between laughing and crying, or between altruism and spite, or between altruism and self-interest. We get the fundamental difference that's there, and yet we can express so much of it in ways that are so similar that we can actually collapse one into the other in some of our ways of thinking about it. And oddly, and I'm not going to demonstrate it today, we'll talk about it in the next episode, but oddly, it's the same thing with a libertarian or socialist perspective on how we respond to injustice in our world and how we address it and what public policies we should establish and enact and how they'll bring about the best result for the most people for the greatest period of time and so on. In thinking through those things, what we recognize is that this irony about opposites is an irony that's just true about different human beings who think different things, different thoughts about things, and have different solutions to them. And so what I want to do to close out today and then just lead into the next discussion is give you why this is so important to me. The longer I live, the more intertwined I realize everything is. And I think that would be the nature of just having more and more experience over a lifetime. It's not like, oh, I've made a genius observation. I mean, I just happen to have lived this long. And when you've lived a long time, you've seen a lot of things dovetail with each other that you thought were completely unrelated. And lo and behold, they're not completely unrelated. They happen to fit in with each other quite nicely. And so the realization of that makes me realize that there are fewer. So I'm going to say this. I don't mean nobody's ever wrong. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying that. Don't hear it. But I do want to say this. The longer I live and the more intertwined I realize everything is, the fewer opinions and ideas I realize there are, which are simply completely useless. It's just not the case. And it doesn't mean that they're right, but it does mean that they're not useless. And, it's a fairly shocking recognition when you realize you've been discarding ideas and information your entire life as useless, and then you realize it's growing entire plants down in the dump where you were throwing it. Yes, things like that have happened. But on the negative side, I learned how to take advantage of this as a young person. I learned how to pretend like this was true, make it as if it were true, and abuse it. So on the negative, I'm saying on the negative side, but I did it all the time. And I mean, it's an empowering tool. And I see people do it all the time now, not just young people, all the way through life. I see people do it. And it really bothers me. So it became glaringly obvious to me, and it has now become glaringly obvious to me when I see people do what I was doing as that high school debater, meaning I could, I would have an argument I needed to make. As a debater, you're just thrown into the room and, oh, you're going to be negative or you're going to be affirmative, meaning you're going to embrace this idea or you're going to tear it to shreds. Which one am I going to do? I don't know. I'll tell you in a minute. And you would do it with any idea they gave you, whatever the resolution was for the year. So it's not like you developed an opinion about the truth and then that's what you defended in your debate. What you learned was rhetorically to make any case you wanted to make. Make sure you can get from point A to point Z or from point A to point Z prime. Either way, you got to create a path. So you learn to use rhetoric and you learn to use argumentation and you learn to use evidence and ideas to bridge the chasm, as I've described before, to sort of break through the wall in the maze. Yeah, it's not the right way to go, but it gets you there. We learn to do that with rhetoric. And man, do I see politicians or people on television or whatever doing this all the time. And because they're creative, because they are crafty, because they are cunning, they can find the way through. And I'm not even saying that critically of them without being critical of myself. I did the same thing for the longest time. When I was a preacher, embarrassingly, I would do it with a text. I know what this text means, so I'm going to make it say that, no matter what. I wasn't trying to be manipulative or deceptive, but I was using things to say what I believed they ought to say because I knew I could get there. And it didn't matter what evidence was contrary to it. On the negative side, it's really easy to do that. And again, now that I'm older, it's glaringly obvious when I see people doing it. And it really, I mean, that's the most challenging environment for me not to be judgmental, because I'm seeing so much of myself in what I'm seeing them do. It's usually the people we have the hardest time with are the people who are most similar to us. You've seen parents that way. I can't believe my daughter acts this way. Have you seen yourself? So we're all that way. Same with all of us. Anyway, but there is a positive side to it as well. Meaning, I was saying the negative side is, if you realize how intertwined all ideas are, then you realize you can use any idea to get to any other idea. However many steps it takes, however many leaps you have to make, however many obfuscations you have to use, you can get there. That's on the negative side. But there's a positive recognition about how intertwined all these ideas are as well. And on the positive side, the way it has helped me, and this is just me, it's helped me, it means no matter where the person is I'm speaking with, no matter where they begin, I realize there are common grounds for the beginning of a conversation. There is something in what they're saying that I can find an ideological way to connect with, a rhetorical or ideological way to connect with. And I mean a conversation, not just a diatribe. Is there ever a time for a diatribe? You've listened to my episodes, you know, I can get there. But yeah, there is. And Jesus creates something of a diatribe against religious leaders in Matthew 23. There can be a time for just saying harshly what needs to be said and for people to hear it. That can happen. But I'm talking about a conversation, not that. Not just an argument. Is there ever a time for an argument? Yeah, there is. And I mean a disagreeable argument, not just making a case logically. I mean, an argument, like, you know, a disagreement, a verbal fight. Yeah, there is. And sure, Jesus even has a rhetorical takedown of his interlocutors on a number of occasions, including when they question whether he has the authority to forgive sin, just as an example. But there are a handful of cases where he does that. So, yeah, is there ever a time for diatribe? Yeah. Is there ever a time for argument? Yeah. But I'm not talking about that. I'm saying recognizing how similar ideas can be, realizing how closely connected they can be, can create an opportunity for a conversation with anyone. And those are the things. Conversations are the things Jesus has throughout the Gospels. They're pervasive. It's the default style of communication from Peter and Andrew. Think about what Jesus is doing when he's interacting with them. To Philip and Nathaniel. Oh, you know, I saw you standing under the tree and I knew you were a son of Israel. Oh, you knew because of... Remember the conversations from insider Nicodemus, John 3, we all know that conversation, to the outcast Samaritan woman in John 4, the next chapter, all the way down to Judas in the upper room and John at the cross. Jesus is having conversations constantly. He's having conversations with people so wrong, they required the intervention of God himself to completely transform them, for them to become his people. With those kinds of people, Almighty God had conversations. Perhaps, maybe, we can too.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.